Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who has both casual and formal golf shoes, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. There's lots to talk about this week. But before we get to our guests, I thought I'd give you my two cents about the match. The proposed winner-take-all $10 million match between Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson to take place at some time in the not-too-distant future at Shadow Creek in Las Vegas. First off, I think I'd like it more if they were each putting up their own money. Not sponsor money. Tiger puts up five. Phil puts up five. To them, it's lunch money. And they play for that. Second, I'm watching. I'm all in. But I think it could be the worst thing for golf. Now, wait. I get the argument that anything that draws the casual sports fan to watch golf is good. However, I believe that the more golf shows that the only people worth watching are a nearly 50-year-old arthritic man and a broken legend whose better days are in the rearview mirror. Look, I wish some of today's stars resonated with sports fans like Tiger and Phil. The sad part is, I think that several of them, Ricky, Jordan, JT, and Rory, just to name a few, have the charisma to do so. I just don't know if they have the desire to be like those two. You see, to reach that level, one has to be willing to sacrifice personally, big time. And I just don't know if those guys are willing to do that. Or that we should blame them if they don't. Look, it's an interesting dilemma on all sides. Hey, today on the show, we'll chat with Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com on the state of women's professional golf. I think they've got some real problems on the LPGA, and it's got nothing to do with quality of play. Also, he's on location at the site of the inaugural U.S. Senior Women's Open, and the lineup there is amazing. ECU golfer Blake Taylor qualified and played in the PGA Tour event at the Greenbrier last week. We will hear from him all about that. But we begin today with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, as we've been waiting for the new PGA Tour schedule to come out. Okay, Ron, the moment we've all been waiting for came this week. We finally get our look at the revamped 2018-2019 PGA Tour schedule. A couple of things that jumped out at me immediately were, for the first time in a long time, we got the first half of the season right after the first of the year with a proper West Coast swing, then Mexico breaking up, being the halfway point, the WGC event in Mexico, and then we go to the Florida swing. All of that makes sense for the first time in about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I think what emerged with the new schedule is, as we, those of us sort of follow it along, have pretty well pieced it together. You know, from the time this tournament announced this to that tournament announced it was doing this, you could pretty well put all the pieces together. But it was nice to see it that way. And I think two things jump out. If we move past sort of the wraparound part of what we'll see in the fall when we get to the first of the year, I think it's going to feel, I don't know if fast and furious, but it's obviously condensed. I mean, the season's going to end a month earlier than it has been ending, and there's going to be that whole roll of player championship into the majors. And you're right. I think that you can almost see the little chapters broken up. Out in Hawaii, then the West Coast, and, as you said, Mexico. We had four straight weeks in Florida, and then, I mean, it just keeps going. I think there's a whole lot to like about that schedule, and particularly I think the best part of it, well, the best part I think is the lineup of the players in the majors. The second best part is the fact that they're down to three FedEx Cup playoff events, and they will be done on August 25th.
Yeah, they're finally getting out of football's way, which has been needing to happen for a long time. If I was going to pick just one loser in the first part of the schedule, again, omitting the wraparound stuff, the little engine that could, especially after what Tiger did last year, the big success story has been the building of the Valspar Championship at Innisbrook. And in the new schedule, they are now sandwiched between the Players' Championship and the match play. In other words, their field, I think, is really going to suffer unless Tiger chooses to play in it again.
Yeah, I think, you know, as you look at it, that was one of the ones like, okay, it might be hard because the way things sort of stack up. And if you're playing just the Tiger game, okay, you know he's going to play Bay Hill. Theoretically, he will have played himself back into the match play. So is he going to play three in a row, play Valspar, then take a week off before the Masters? I don't know. That's one of the places it gets squeezed. The other one that really jumps out at me, and I had a sense that it was coming, but until you actually see it, that they make all the big noise about moving the WGC from Akron to Memphis for FedEx, and yet it's going to follow immediately the week after the Open Championship. So they will go from Northern Ireland to Memphis next year, which is quite a change.
And actually, it's broken up by a week. They're going from the Open Championship to the Barbasol in Kentucky, and then from Kentucky to Memphis.
The Barbasol is actually the same week as
Oh, it is. It's the same week. Okay, I was looking at the date. You're right. It's taking place the same week as the Open. You're right. So, yeah, so, from Ireland to Memphis, yeah, that's not a shock to your body.
Plus, I mean, if you think about, like, some of the top European guys like Fleetwood, like Rahm, other guys like Ricky Fowler, what they do, I mean, going over, and the European Tour will take July and have the Irish Open, the Scottish Open, and the Open Championship. There's three in a row. Now, most guys probably don't play all three, but then to turn around and get them to go all the way to Memphis for that, when they'll have then 1 week, which will be Wyndham, and then they go into the playoffs. It's a lot, and I think, I don't know the details, but I have it on good authority that there will be a tweak involving the Wyndham Championship that will try to convince a lot of players maybe from 50th on down in the FedEx Cup thing to come play it. I don't know what the details are, but I know there's been some discussion about doing something with the Wyndham Championship that would add a little more incentive there.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. We're looking at the brand new schedule for the PGA Tour 2018-2019. Big sigh of relief as far as I'm concerned. I love the spot for the Wells Fargo Championship. It comes two or three weeks after Augusta, and it's got a week after it before the PGA at Bethpage. I just think it's a sweet spot right after the Zurich Classic in New Orleans.
I'm with you. I think they landed exactly where they expected to land and where they wanted to land. You're right. Guys aren't going to skip from the Masters to the PGA. They're going to play somewhere, and now Wells Fargo, Quail Hollow, I think just lines right up as the place they're going to play.
Another tournament that, as I glance further down the schedule, Valspar, we're both in agreement, is in a tough spot. I also think the RBC Canadian Open is in a tough spot. It comes immediately after Jack's tournament and the week before the U.S. Open.
Well, yeah, but it's been in a tough spot anyway. I mean, following the Open Championship, they chartered the plane and get guys back over there as they'll do it after Carnoustie. But I think, you know, trying to find the right spot, I think they're excited about that. I think it's, it has the cachet of being the Canadian Open. It's been bounced around. It's probably been treated a little, given its historical significance, maybe a little unfairly or a little rougher than it might have otherwise. I think they're happy for the change and see where it goes from there.
Ron, I guess Kevin Na is not going to have to defend his title next year.
Well, I think the Greenbrier will be back on the schedule, but I think they will be on the fall portion of the 1920 schedule.
Ah, okay.
Like Houston will be. I think they're going there. This is my sense, what I understand. Because they're not part of this fall schedule, they will then be part of the next fall schedule, but that does not, you got to figure out which part of which calendar you're in. So they will be part of calendar 2019, just not the 18-19 season, is my understanding.
Are you surprised? And I guess I shouldn't be, because I know the way the business world works, and I know Quicken Loans wanted to get back up to Detroit. But you're a little surprised that major cities like Washington, D.C. and Boston, Massachusetts are no longer on the PGA Tour schedule?
Surprised a little bit by the Washington thing, only because you would have thought with Tiger's involvement there that they would have found a way to make that work, but it just didn't. And so now it's gone. I think Boston will remain on the schedule, but my sense is it's going to be an every other year thing. I think it and the New York stop I think the Northern Trust, it's my understanding, one of those two pre-Tour Championships event will alternate with Boston, keeping TPC Boston there every other year. I don't think that's been announced, but I expect that that will happen. I don't think that will be the last time they're playing up there when we go up there this fall, later this summer.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. I brought his name up a few minutes ago. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Kevin Na. Whenever I think of Kevin Na, for better or for worse, I always think about when he was leading after 54 holes at the Players a few years ago and had the yips off the tee and would take these vicious swings and miss the ball on purpose. And it was awful to watch. But he seems to be a really likable guy. He apparently is very well liked by the guys on tour, and that was a really cool win last week for him.
Well, I mean, for those of us from around here who kind of quietly or not so quietly hoping it was Harold Varner's day, I mean, the suspense ended almost immediately. I mean, Kevin Na goes out there and made 5 birdies in 6 holes in a hurry and sort of just seized control of it. I mean, he's a different guy. He does it his own way. He is a quirky player, you know. I mean, he's faster than he was, but that doesn't mean he's fast.
No, but he acknowledges the fact that he's slow and that he's working on it. Well, and so part of that makes it forgivable.
Yeah, and he had a little strut going there toward the end Sunday. And, you know, he's fought through a lot of things. I mean, almost 7 years since his other tour win. I mean, he's been a very, very good player. You go back and look where he's ranked, like in the FedEx Cup standings at the end of the year. I mean, he has rarely been outside the top 30. You know, he doesn't win often, but he has built a very solid career.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there was a stat tweeted out on Sunday by the Golf Channel, and it was really stunning when you think about it. In the last 10 years, he's had 55 or 56 top 10 finishes, and he has won $26 million for his career. He's got 2 wins. That's in the upper echelon of the PGA Tour, and it's one of those I wonder how many guys there are that are like that are just quietly having really solid careers out there that you don't really think about.
Well, I think example one is Charles Howell.
Oh, I mean, ATM machine.
Yeah, he's won 30-some million dollars, maybe in the top 15 career money winners or something, and he's won 2 tournaments. Yeah, some guys are just that way. I mean, as popular as Matt Kuchar is, what has he won, 4 tournaments or something like that, maybe 5? Which is a lot now, but you know, you just sort of think when you see the totals, you think, well, they must have won just, you know, a dozen or so, and they haven't actually done that. So, but yeah, I mean, Kevin Na is a guy who quietly stacked it up much more efficiently than we probably realized. But then you get a week like that, and you say, well, look here.
I'm glad you brought up Harold Varner III. I was like you. I may have even tweeted out that you're not supposed to publicly root, but really rooting, because it could have been a really big weekend for Harold Varner and his career. It's not that it was awful. He had a top 5 finish, and he got inside the top 125, so all of that is good. But do you think Harold Varner's takeaway from the weekend is discouraging or encouraging based on what happened on Sunday?
Encouraging, because I played golf with Harold Varner on the Monday afternoon after Greenbrier, and he was pumped up. I mean, he said, you know, it became apparent early that he wasn't going to win, and he was disappointed he didn't make one more birdie to get one of those open championship spots. But he said, I didn't have my best stuff, and I hung in there as best I could. He said, I was encouraged by that. I mean, he's such an sort of eternally optimistic guy. That, you know, he said, I mean, that was a fun day to me. You know, he would have liked it to turn out better, but he said he just had so much fun playing golf. And he's off to the John Deere Classic and use it as a learning experience, picked up a couple things. And if you thought he was just going to be moping around, you know, everybody probably saw the picture of him mowing his mother's grass
yes.
the next morning and all that stuff. He said, well, you know, I do that a lot, but I don't know why people make it a big deal. So that's what you're supposed to do. But, yeah, he came away feeling pretty good about where he is in his season and with his game right now.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, I think of him sometimes the way I used to think of, and you'll remember this name, Dana Quigley, on the old days of the Senior Tour. You know, Dana Quigley played every week. He was the Iron Man of the Senior Tour. And I just, he didn't get in the Open Championship, and that may be a blessing because, hell, Harold may need to take a week off. I think he plays more than anyone else on tour.
Well, he says he just likes to play. I mean, we had something prearranged, and for him to come out and play golf with me and a couple guys Monday afternoon, I mean, yeah, now he was not grinded, but I mean, he was just out there having a good time laughing, and he says, I just have too much fun playing. What else am I going to do?
Get you out of here on this. Have you been checking the weather in advance in Scotland? What is your suitcase going to be packed with?
Well, it's a lot better looking. It's a lot more typical looking right now than it was maybe a week ago. I mean, some of those Irish Open pictures and everything, it's been so warm and dry over there. Now, warm for them is different than what we would call warm. I looked up one of the BBC weather broadcasts the other day just to see, and you know, they were practically warning people to stay inside between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. because it was going to get into the low 80s. And I'm like, that's a good one. But according to what I've looked so far, it's going to be proper over there. Mid-60s, you know, low 50s at night, mid-60s in the day with some, it's probably going to rain one day. It looks like everything needs rain over there. And then some breeze. So, you know, when you get out there to Carnoustie, I mean, that's sort of out there exposed a little bit. I think it will have plenty of proper Open Championship conditions.
Now, have you ever graced Carnoustie with your magnificent golf game?
I have played Carnoustie once, and I still have a picture somewhere in my phone of hitting my tee shot on the first hole into one of those pot bunkers and being about 6 inches from the front of it and trying to figure out what I was going to do in any direction from there. But we caught it on a benign day. It was not real hard and set up easy. I think I remember parring the 16th hole and the 18th hole, but not from the same place that those guys will be playing it from. You could see how it could be just an absolute bear. I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen to you out there, and I imagine some of them are going to happen next week.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr., and when we return, what's it like to be a college golfer, then qualify for and compete in a PGA Tour event? ECU's Blake Taylor takes dead aim at that very thing that he accomplished last week at the Greenbrier, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Joining us now, East Carolina golfer Blake Taylor, who qualified for and competed in last week's PGA Tour event at the Greenbrier. Look, you're a consistent starter last year for the Pirates, scoring average just over 72, low round a 65. First off, following the season, I'm sure you had in mind, you know, most of what you wanted to do golf-wise over the summer. How much of your off time is spent just playing and practicing versus tournaments to keep your competitive edge sharp? So, in other words, when you're plotting out your summer, what's your balance there?
In summer, I love playing. I know practice is necessary, and that's one place in my game that I have to work at is not to forget to practice too much. But I love playing, and so in the summer, I normally try to load up with as many tournaments as possible. So I stay busy. I'm obviously still practicing several times a week, but it feels like I'm playing at least every other week, if not even more than that, in some tournament somewhere.
Now, when you were thinking about your schedule heading into the summer, did you have on there try to qualify for the Greenbrier, or was this just something that came up?
I was looking at it. I thought about it last year and didn't for some reason. We plans fell through or whatever, and so this year I was like, you know what, I actually want to do it, I want to go try it. And so we had planned it kind of at the beginning of the year, or at the beginning of the summer, and we're like, all right, we're going to set this little weekend aside and go up there and try it.
Now, where was the qualifier held?
It was in Daniels, West Virginia, about an hour from the Greenbrier at Glade Springs Resort.
Oh, okay, Glade Springs. Now, had you played that track before?
I had not. I got up there Thursday before the pre-qualifier and walked the course and played some holes, but that was the first time I'd seen it.
So sort of tell people the process here, because you just used a term pre-qualifier that I don't think people are aware of. So explain the whole process of qualifying to play in a PGA tournament.
For me, and a lot of mini pros, but any amateur that doesn't have any kind of status, you have to go through a pre-qualifier, which is held on Friday before the Monday qualifier, and they take top 30 or 40 or so. And the score ended up being 71 is what got in to the qualifier, which is where you get into the field with the PGA guys and other guys that are trying to qualify for the Greenbrier.
Now, how many people were in the pre-qual?
It was a lot. It was over 100. They had tee times starting at 7:30 and going till I was the last tee time at, I think, 3:10.
Well, at least you didn't have to sweat it. Once you walked off the course, you knew what you were doing, right?
Exactly. We knew there was no get in and then stress out for 4 hours. It was once I was in on the pre-qualifier, I knew I was good to go.
Blake Taylor is a golfer at East Carolina, qualified and played in the Greenbrier last week. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, so you're in the qualifier on Monday. When did you tee off then, and how long did you have to sweat that out?
I teed off at 8:30.
Oh, God!
Yeah, they did double tee on Monday. On Friday, everybody went off one, and they double teed us on Monday. So I was 8:30 off 10 and had to wait a little bit, but the last time was about 10:30, I want to think, so it wasn't nearly as bad.
Oh, okay. I was just thinking all of a sudden you're getting done 4 hours before the last group comes in.
It was about 2 hours, so it was definitely stressful time, but I was trying to take my mind off of it, but it wasn't. I was stressing the whole wait.
Okay, so the pre-qualifier, more than 100 golfers. How many golfers were actually in the Monday qual?
It was probably around 70 or 80, if I had to guess.
And what was the score that you shot that got you in?
66. Got in par 71, so it was 5 under 66. And that got in a four-way playoff for three spots.
Which was more nerve-wracking? Waiting for everyone to get finished and see how you did, or walking out and participating in that four-man playoff?
Honestly, waiting. Waiting was definitely, I think, worse, because as far as playoffs go, that was one of the easier ones for me. I don't know why, but I guess being 4 for 3, you know, only one guy had to mess up and you were guaranteed to get in. So the waiting was stressful because I was thinking, okay, if anyone else comes in, you know, the spots keep chipping away. But luckily, after I came in, there was already four other guys with 66 and one guy with 65. So I knew there was going to be a playoff as soon as I came in. And luckily, no one after me shot that score or lower.
Blake Taylor, ECU golfer, qualified for the Greenbrier last week. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, so you head out for the 4 for 3 playoff. How many holes did that go?
I was out on the first one. We had two pars, me and one other guy made par, and then one guy made bogey, was in trouble off the tee, and then the third guy hit it on the green and three-putted. So luckily I didn't have to stress too long in the playoff.
Okay, so you go back with your family. All of a sudden, the let's make a weekend out of this becomes we're going to make a week out of this. What's it like scrambling for accommodations and everything else for that week?
It was pretty stressful because we knew it was busy, obviously, as busy as White Sulphur Springs gets. Probably their busiest busiest week of the year. But the first night, we luckily found a place about 15 minutes out. And then the problem was the Monday qualifiers, they didn't have their names at the resort. So we couldn't just walk up Monday afternoon and say, hey, I'm playing, because they didn't have our names yet.
I'm just picturing all of a sudden, man, this is so great. Where the hell are we going to sleep tonight?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. We were thinking for a little bit, like, all right, are we going to be sleeping in the car?
I was just thinking this is a car sleeping situation. All right, so now you know you're in the field at a PGA Tour event. And, you know, look, you're a D1 golfer, and so that tells me you've won your fair share of events. And for the vast majority of your life, when you walk on a range, you feel more than you belong. You feel like you own the place. This has got to be a whole different vibe, though. What's it like that first time that you step on the range at the Greenbrier and you're inside the ropes and they're scrambling to get you the really good range balls that these guys play with, and you take your place on the range with the best golfers in the world? What is that feeling like for you?
It was a lot different, especially Tuesday when we got out there, and I just wanted to get out and practice a little bit before we went for a practice round. And being on the range was probably the biggest difference that I noticed, just because there's ropes and stuff everywhere. I played several amateur tournaments before where they have ropes around the tees and around the greens to keep spectators off, but not on the range. There's never anything on the range, and now there's a huge leaderboard and huge tents and trailers everywhere. And so that was definitely a different feel. And then just to look down, walking down the range, see all the names that are, you know, hidden right next to me, it was definitely a wild feeling.
What are you nervous about that first shot on the range? Because I have a feeling that I would have a fear of being Ten Cup McAvoy and starting to hit, you know, just huge hosel rockets down and I nail Lee Jansen or somebody. I mean, you know, that would be my greatest fear. Was there any fear when you took that first shot, or were you like, oh, okay?
Yeah, a little bit. But as far as that goes, I was confident enough to just know, you know, just focus on what you normally do and just hit it like normal and you'll be fine.
And that's the difference between people who know what they're doing and people like me. Blake Taylor's an ECU golfer, qualified for the Greenbrier, our guest taking Dead Aim. So you went out and played a practice round. I know Harold Varner's an ECU guy. Were you able to make contact with him, or who did you play with?
Yeah, I texted him on and off. I texted him right after I qualified and asked if he was playing, and he said he was. So I was pretty excited. But our schedules throughout the week were pretty off. He played in the pro-am on Wednesday, and they closed the course to people that weren't playing in the pro-am, which I wasn't, so I had to get my practice round in Tuesday. He was taking it light because he was playing Wednesday, so we didn't play with him, but we did text back and forth a few times about the course and stuff like that. But I actually did get to play with Jim Furyk on Tuesday, which was
what a thrill.
Fun experience. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I know Jim treated you great, but how were the other pros towards you? Were they excited for you? Or did you feel like you were welcomed out there?
Yeah, definitely. The guys I played with, I mean, they were, everybody I played with was great guys. They all asked me about how school was going, you know, how y'all want to do this for a living, and you know, family, all that kind of stuff. So it definitely made me feel welcome. It was a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it.
Okay, but let's get to round one. Who were your playing partners with for the first two rounds?
Omar Uresti and Rob Oppenheim.
Is Omar still a teaching pro?
I believe so, yeah. I know he does a lot of playing, but I'm pretty sure he is.
Yeah, because all of a sudden he'll pop up in the PGA, but under the you know, teaching professionals division now, even though I remember him from when he was on tour. So that's interesting. He was out there. And I remember checking my phone at the beach. I was following your progress. And, dude, you were scary for a while. You were like 3-under through your first 8 or 9 holes. Were you pinching yourself?
Yeah, kind of. I was going out, starting out thinking, you know, just make a lot of pars. And that was my focus, was just make pars and try to make as few bogeys as possible. And I was hitting it okay, but I was starting on the easier side, but putts were going in. That was the biggest thing. None of my birdie putts I made were really close, especially the one on 17. It was about a 40-some footer. And when that went in, I was kind of like, whoa, you know, what are you doing?
Now, learning to keep your focus when you go low or you're going low is one thing. And it's one thing if you're at a college tournament or if you're at a, at an amateur event. It's another when you're on the pro tour and all of a sudden you look up and you're like, wow, that standard says I'm three under. How hard was it for you to keep focused on each individual shot at that point?
It was difficult, but that's one good thing. I've been in situations like that in other big tournaments, so I tried to just treat it like that and tried to treat it like it was just another tournament. But it is hard, you know, saying it's just another tournament when it's you're playing with the guys you're playing with and there's crowds starting to form and stuff like that. So,
did you use a local caddy or was your dad on the bag? Or
my dad was on the bag.
How thrilled was he? I mean, he you probably still can't erase the smile off his face, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he had a lot of fun. And it was, he actually, when I got through the first round of qualifying, he came up for the Monday qualifier and caddied for me and that. And so we kind of got adjusted, I guess. Got adjusted to the new distances and stuff because the elevation
right.
all goes a little further.
Now,
but yeah, he had a lot of fun, and we had a lot of fun together.
That's awesome. Now, the second nine didn't go as well as the first. What were you thinking when you walked off the course? Was it disappointment? Was it were you encouraged? Were you just or was it such excitement of what you were doing that you didn't care? You just didn't want to leave the course.
Yeah, it was disappointment at first because I mean, I knew I was 300, and I knew there's no reason I shouldn't have shot under par that first day, at least one or two under. But, you know, then my dad was like, hey, look, I mean, that's still a good round. You're still not out of it. Good round tomorrow, and we're still playing the weekend. So it quickly went to, you know, okay, yeah, I'm just glad I'm here again. But it was definitely a little disappointment at first.
Yeah, and then you didn't make the cut, so ended on Friday. But how do you feel heading into next fall with this behind you now?
It's a big confidence builder because I putted really well this past week, but I didn't hit it well at all, not nearly as good as I normally do. And I know that if I did hit it like normal, then I feel like I would have made the cut pretty easily. I would have been 3, 4, 5 under. So I'm taking that away from it.
What's left for you for the rest of the summer? Are you going to try to qualify for anything else in a pro world, or are you looking at some major amateur events? What are you doing?
I've got the Carolinas Am this weekend in Pinehurst at Country Club of North Carolina. And then I leave straight from that on Sunday and go to Kentucky for the Southern Am.
Going to try to qualify for the US Am? I know there's a bunch of US Am qualifiers coming up in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Yep, I have that right when I get back from the Southern. I think I have one or two days off, and then I play in my US Am qualifier up in at Scotch Hall.
Well, cool, man. Well, best of luck to you the rest of the summer and heading into your fall season. I know Coach Sapp was just blown away with excitement about what you were doing. So best of luck to you, okay?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Wow, what a thrill, huh? And I bet the carryover and confidence for him heading into next fall for ECU cannot even be measured. That's Blake Taylor. Up next, where are we on the LPGA Tour and the first ever U.S. Senior Women's Open? Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com takes Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I know no bigger proponent of women's professional golf than my friend from RonCyrak.com, Ron Cyrak. Ron, as I look over the major championship season so far on the LPGA Tour, we've had 3 playoffs. I mean, the A&A had Lindbergh, Park, and Song, the U.S. Open, Jatanagarn and Kim, KPMG Women's PGA, Park,
Hataoka. Yeah, NASA Hataoka.
Yes, and then the, you know, So Young-Yu in that playoff. On paper, on paper, it's just really should be an exciting major championship season. And when you watch it, it is. But then when I'm watching the KPMG playoff and I'm flipping back and forth with the U.S. Senior Open that's going on simultaneously, it's not. It hit me. It's not a quality of play issue. The girls are outstanding. The shots they're making are just totally on point. But it's a huge marketing issue, and I don't know if there's an answer to it, Ron. I think there may be no tougher job in sports than marketing director for the LPGA.
Well, actually, you know, the marketing of it is they don't have a problem marketing to sponsors. What they need is better TV exposure, and I think that that's one of Commissioner Mike Wann's. If you talk to him right now, his two main goals, he's happy with the number of tournaments they have. Two main goals are to increase prize money and to get network TV exposure. As great of a job as Golf Channel does covering the tour, when you're on Golf Channel, you're preaching to the choir. And
you're right.
These people are already golf fans. You need to be on network TV to grow your fan base and to expand into that casual sports fan and draw them into the tent. I've always said the people who are the biggest critics of the LPGA, both among fans and among the media, are people who don't go to their events. Once you go to their events, you realize what a great entertainment value it is.
Well, no, and they do such a great job. I remember when Craig Kann was the communications director. He did what I thought was a really, really, really good job of stressing to the ladies the importance of social media, super serving the fans and sponsors at events and pro-ams. And I think they do a great job. It's like you said, if you go to one of the events, you're knocked out by these ladies. They're fantastic. Maybe it is a network thing, but, you know, when I was listening, you were talking about the Golf Channel and whatnot, and they do preach to the choir. But then again, I think that Brant Boone, he may be the most passionate guy about the LPGA outside of you that I know. The people who are working the events are really, they're super serving it on air, too. They're doing a great job.
Yeah, I think Jerry Foltz is one of the really underappreciated on-course commentators, too. He's really terrific at what he does. And when Judy Rankin's in there, she's as good as there is anywhere. They do give it really, really top-notch quality coverage there. But as I said, to reach that, to grow your fan base, to reach the casual fan, I mean, look, there were a lot of people who didn't care at all about golf who would turn in when Tiger Woods is doing something, you know, and that's sort of what the LPGA needs. They probably don't have any one single player out there right now who moves the needle in that sort of way. Michelle Wee's probably the closest thing to it, but she's not really lived up to the promise of her potential. But she does bring in that casual fan. But that's, you know, that's the next goal for them is to how do you reach those people who aren't your hardcore base of your fan group.
Is there, if they did get that network exposure though, Ron, is there a foreign player who has the charisma to captivate golf fans and or the casual sports fan in this country?
There's a lot, and you know, and I think So-Yeon Yoo is one. I think that Inbi Park is one, and Shan-Shan Fong is one. Shan-Shan may be the funniest human being on the planet, you know, and it's just a question of getting their stories out there and getting people to know who they are. Look, in a lot of ways, Asia's embraced America better than America's embraced Asia. Virtually all of the players come over now speak English, and they understand that it helps their marketing potential. And some of them, like in the case of Shan-Shan Fong, she played junior golf here, so she's been here a long time. So it becomes it drives me nuts when I hear TV commentators mispronounce names, because it's really just a question of memorization and doing your homework. And I always come back to the fact is everybody learned how to pronounce Mike Krzyzewski's name. You know, and if you can look at the letters that form his name and come up with that pronunciation, then you can do anything.
Well, in all fairness, we all did butcher Krzyzewski for at least the first couple of years till he started winning. That's a great point, though. Ron Cyrak from ronsyrak.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's move on to a historic week at the Thornberry Classic in Wisconsin. Look, it's one thing to set a record. It's another thing to break a record that's held by Annika Sörenstam, and it's still another to shatter it by four shots. Se Young Kim shoots 31 under for a 72-hole tournament, and I think the most impressive thing was she's 24 under going into the last day, knowing she just has to shoot, 69 to tie the record, and she's as cool as the other side of the pillow. She goes out and strokes a 65.
And she knew what she was doing. I mean, she wanted the record, and she actually said that, and that she was going out to try to get it. The other thing that's astounding about it is how effortlessly she did it. She missed some putts. She missed a couple of 6-7 foot putts. She could have been even lower. The astounding stat for me is she hit 67 greens, which is ridiculous in its own right. You hit 67 out of 72 greens. That's pretty. But she converted almost half of her attempts. She made 31 birdies and an eagle. So she hit 67 greens, and 32 times, she got either a birdie or an eagle on the hole. That's pretty remarkable. That's taking advantage of the opportunities in front of you. The next thing for Se Young is she shot 27 under in the 2016 Founders Cup. She shoots 31 under now. She's won 7 tournaments in a little over 3.5 years. She's clearly, with her A game, one of the top players in the world. But she was, went into the Thornberry only ranked 21 in the Rolex rankings. So what that says to me is she's got to figure out how to get the job done when she doesn't have her best stuff, And that's what real champions do. Tiger Woods won with his B game a lot, She's sort of like, in my mind, like Rory McIlroy. McIlroy, when he has his A game,
yes,
is probably the best player in the world, but he doesn't struggle well. When he doesn't have his A game, he shoots 75. Yeah, he shot 74 on Sunday at the Masters.
Yeah.
And that's the next thing Se Young's got to learn is how can you come up with a decent score when you don't have your good game?
Ron, one of my favorite people on the LPGA Tour is hanging them up for the remainder of the season on maternity leave after this week. Stacey Lewis, talk a little bit about how important she's been to the game of golf for this country on the LPGA Tour and her future. Is she planning on coming back?
Yeah, she carried the American golf on her shoulders for a couple of years, from about 2012 to 2014. She was twice Player of the Year, first American to be Player of the Year since Beth Daniel, that ended a really long drought. She had as much to do with the creation of the KPMG Women's PGA Championship as anybody. KPMG is one of her endorsement partners, and She contributed a lot of when they started talking about the event, and she said we got to go to top golf courses. She understands the business model of the LPGA really well. I remember at the press conference when they announced the KPMG Women's, she got the question about, hey, are there too many Asians on tour? And her answer was, without Asia, I'm not sure the LPGA makes it through the recession.
Yeah, she's
Asia
right.
Carried us, she's a very insightful, very smart person. Her due date is in November. She's planning on being back out on tour in January. Interesting thing, this is her last tournament before maternity leave at Marathon. Her caddy, Travis, her regular caddy, is here this week at the Senior Women's Open, caddying for his aunt, Tammy Green. I asked him, I said, well, how did that discussion go? He said, no, it wasn't really a discussion. I said to Stacey, hey, I want a caddy for my aunt. And she said, okay. So
that's great. Thank you for bringing up where you are right now. Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. This week you're covering an inaugural event that I think is a long time coming, the United States Senior Women's Open. First off, why has it taken the USGA so long to have this championship?
Yeah, because if you look at it, the creation of the Men's Senior Open really launched the Champions Tour. That was created in 1980, and it really became a springboard for an entire tour. There is the Legends Tour in women's golf, which is their version of the Senior Tour, but it doesn't have all that many events, and hopefully the creation of this will help that. I'm not entirely sure why it took them as long as they did, but I can tell you what, they've really gotten it right this week so far. This is, first off, we're at Chicago Golf Club, one of the five founding members of the USGA, one of the most exclusive clubs. There's like 120 members in this club. It's like nobody knows about this golf course except that it's an amazing golf course. So that says a lot. It sort of gives the event instant credibility that it's here. And they're treating the players like it's a major championship. You know, there was USGA people greeting them at the airport. They have courtesy cars. They have engraved nameplates on their lockers. They were all given a Tiffany plate commemorating the event. And last night I went to the past champions dinner. And by the way, when they started reading off the past USGA champions in attendance at dinner, it took about 15 minutes to do it. There were so many of them there.
Before we go any further with who all is participating, because I really want to talk about that, you mentioned the Chicago Golf Club. You have tweeted out your love for the place. Tell people how just amazing that track is.
Yeah, I mean, you don't. It's hard to figure. You know, when I try to think of what golf courses I compare it to, you know, I think of National Golf Links on Long Island. I think of Sunningdale in England.
Oh wow!
It's very traditional in the sense that you can play the ball both in the air and on the ground. Greens are massive, and so you can do a lot of run up. It's a perfect look. Honestly, when the USGA was looking for a venue for the first event, one of the things that they really wanted was a golf course where you could play the ball on the ground because, you know, not everybody can fly at 200 yards, but everybody can run at 200 yards. And the other thing is that they wanted a very walkable golf course, and this is a walkable golf course. You know, it's old style, greens and tees close together, not a lot of elevation changes. I tweeted a picture today of you. If you walk out to the fourth green and stand at the fourth green, you can see almost every hole on the golf course. You know, there's nothing tricked up about this. It's just all right in front of you.
Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com, our guest taking Dead Aim. I look at some of the names on the tee sheet, and I have the same feeling that I did when I was a little boy and my dad and I sat down and watched the Legends of Golf tournament that was going on in Austin, and these names that you'd heard but you'd never seen them play, or at least I had never seen them play. Joanne Carner, Hollis Stacey, Amy Alcott, Betsy King, Jan Stevenson, Laura Ball. I mean, the list goes on and on. I know where Julie Inkster's been. She pops up from time to time still. But I guess my question is, where have these ladies been? I assume they never quit playing golf. There was just nowhere professionally for them to go, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, they all do a bunch. I mean, you know, I would say that Joanne Carner probably still plays 6 or 7 tournaments a year on the Legends Tour. But there aren't a lot of places for them to play. You know, you run into them a lot at events. I went out on a range yesterday morning, and it looked to me like, I said, wow, this is the tour I started covering 30 years ago when I first came out here. You know, it's like, yeah, they're all there. I mean, you get somebody like Betsy King. Betsy's devoted all of her energy to doing humanitarian work in Africa. You know, she does stuff about clean drinking water and anti-malaria stuff. And about 11 years ago, I spent 2 weeks with her and 5 other LPGA players in Rwanda. Last night at the Champions Dinner, it was amazing to hear the stories being told. It was amazing to see how emotional the players were that this event came to be. You know, a couple of years ago, I played with Joanne Carner in a Legends Tour Pro-Am. And I said to her, I said, you know, Joanne, you're one of only 5 players who've won 3 different USGA championships. It's Palmer, Nicklaus, Woods, Joanne Carner, and Carol Semple Thompson have won 3 different USGA championships. She looked at me and said, yeah. And if they had a senior women's open, I'd be the only one with 4, you know. I thought about that. I thought, well, she's right. She's probably right about that. Joanne is 79. She's going to hit the first ball. She will have the honor of being the first person to strike a ball in competition at the inaugural U.S. Senior Women's Open. And when I asked her, what's your expectations for the week, she said, I'll tell you one thing. It's not going to say DNF on my scorecard.
Well, good.
She said, I'm not going to have a did not finish. I'm going to play, you know. So, and you know what? She'll be grinding. She'll be trying to make the cut.
I'm not sure if the age requirement's the same. You got to be 50 to participate in the Senior Open. But looking down the line, could you see somebody like Annika Sorenstam, who has, you know, been inactive for a while but still plays a little golf? Is this the kind of thing, a U.S. Senior Women's Open, that could get her back on the golf course?
Yeah, you know, that's a confusing thing for me, because my knee-jerk reaction to that is no, is that Annika, you know, Annika won't play unless she can be the best player in the world. You know, that's why she walked away from the game when she did. I mean, she could probably still right now, at age 47, be one of the top 10 players, but she's not happy with being number seven. She wants to be number one. Now, that said, she might relish the challenge. She might relish the fact that her children will start to be old enough to see her play. You know, they've never seen her compete. Those things might play into it. She's got two more. She turns 48 this October, so she's got two more full years until she would be eligible. It could be something that could lure her out. I know this. The USGA will be quietly working very hard to try to get her out here.
It's always good when we can speak with Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com. I'd also like to thank East Carolina golfer Blake Taylor and Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. On the page right now are links to a great profile of Phil Mickelson, what's in the bag of last week's winner Kevin Na, and our video tour of Tidewater Golf Club in Myrtle Beach. Weather-wise, let's see. It's sunny, it's warm, and it's summer in the Carolinas. The days are long, and it should be a pretty good weekend to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt our souls and break our hearts. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.